Good morning, church family. This morning's reading is taken from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 8, verses 2 to 17, and can be found on 676 of the Church Bible. That's 676, Ecclesiastes, chapter 8. Starting to read at verse 2. Obey the king. Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, "What are you doing?" Whoever obeys his command will come to no harm, and the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every matter, though a person may be weighed down by misery. Since no one knows the future, who can tell someone else what is to come? And as no one has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the time of their death. As no one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. All this I saw as I applied my mind to everything done under the sun. There is a time when a man lords it over others to his own hurt. Then too I saw the wicked buried, those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. This too is meaningless. When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. There is something else meaningless that occurs on earth: the righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the labour that is done on earth, people getting no sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it.
Please keep that passage open in front of you, and let me have my welcome to the one Jonathan's already given. My name's Richard, I'm one of the pastors here, and we're delighted you're with us. If you're new particularly, come and say hi afterwards. We'd love to meet you and introduce you to others in the fellowship. Well, in the long history of the British Parliament, only 8 candidates have failed to record even a single vote in a general election. The first was Lord Garver, who stood as the Liberal candidate for Reigate. In 1832, his leadership provoked such indifference that he was the first person on record to poll no votes at all in a general election. But this remarkable feat was then repeated 7 more times over the next 30 years, twice in Tewkesbury, of all places, until someone decided to spare the blushes of candidates by allowing them to vote for themselves. And surprise, surprise, it's never happened since. Sometimes it is easy to spot an unsuitable leader, isn't it? It's obvious. But the reality is that even the most gifted leaders still get things wrong and end up inevitably disappointing those who support them. We live in a fallen world where our leaders often let us down. And you don't need me to tell you that, firstly, because I'm one of your pastors and you know me well, but also because you watch the news. And that's what we've been reminded of, particularly over the last few weeks, isn't it? And when our leaders let us down, how should we respond? Well, often we get disillusioned, don't we? Disappointed, resentful, even bitter, angry. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, the teacher encourages us to respond in a different way. He shows us that the wise way to respond to those in authority over us, especially when they disappoint us and let us down. So on Sunday mornings, as Jonathan's already said, we're returning to the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. We've already covered chapters 1 to 7, and if you missed those, we did that just before Christmas. They are available to listen to on the church website and in the church app. Ecclesiastes, as we saw then, is all about how to find joy in a fallen world. Our guide is the teacher, capital T, probably King Solomon. And his goal is to show us throughout this book how meaningless life is if we only ever seek happiness in life under the sun. So far, we've seen that he's warned us not to seek lasting joy in pleasure, success, work, relationships, religion, and wisdom itself. But in chapter 8, he turns his attention to our leaders, to leadership. He warns us not to pin our hopes on earthly leaders. He reminds us we live in a fallen world, and so our leaders will always inevitably disappoint us. And so in the light of the fact that we live in a fallen world, in the light of the fact that we know our leaders will disappoint us, whoever they are, what is the wise way to respond when leaders let us down? It's a very topical issue actually at the moment, isn't it? In the providence of God, how are we to respond? What is the wise way to respond when our leaders let us down and disappoint us? Well, while the teacher's focus in this chapter is on how to respond to kings, the principles that we see here actually apply in any context where someone has authority over us. I wonder in what context people have authority over you. We see here the wise way to respond, for example, to those in government, local or national, to the police or to those or to public officials, to a boss or a line manager at work, if you play sport, to your coach or the referee or umpire, to teachers, to parents, to church leaders. Submission to those in authority is something we all do, something we all practice in one context or another. So this is a very relevant passage for us. And when it works well, it's a blessing because it brings order, it brings peace, it brings fair play, it gets things done in an efficient way. But because we live in a fallen world, leaders are imperfect. And so they will sometimes let us down and disappoint us and even hurt us as well. And when that happens, which it will, we need wisdom to know how to respond. And that's what the teacher gives us in this chapter. In chapter 7, last time we were in Ecclesiastes, we were in chapter 7, and we saw there how he highlights the importance of wisdom. But then in chapter 8, he gives us a worked example. He shows us how wisdom helps us respond to those in authority over us. We see here five ways wise people respond to leaders. The first wise way to respond to those in authority is to respect their God-given authority. In verses 2 and 3, the teacher repeats a general principle that is taught throughout the Bible, that we're to obey those in authority over us as part of our duty to obey God. Look at verse 2. He says, "Obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence." Now, the principle that the teacher highlights here is very straightforward, isn't it? It's not difficult, it's not complicated. We are to submit to human authorities, to obey the king's command, as he puts it, as part of our submission to God's authority. And that is a principle that's taught throughout the Bible. For example, Luke chapter 20, verse 25, speaking about taxes, Roman tax in that context, Jesus told his disciples, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, we looked at this last year, didn't we? Peter says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake, for that reason, to every human authority. In Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, probably the most comprehensive passage about how we're to respond to those in authority over us, Paul says, those in authority over us are ultimately put there by God. And so if we don't submit to them, we are rebelling against him. Remember, when he was writing, Nero was emperor. Paul says, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. The general principle the teacher teaches in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 in those first two verses is one that's repeated throughout the Bible. When it comes to our leaders, we're to respect their God-given authority. That's what the teacher means in verse 3 when he says, don't be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. What does that mean? Well, he's saying we shouldn't be in a hurry to turn our back on those in authority over us. We're not to be in a hurry to disobey them or to disregard them, even if we disagree with them. And look, this is a lesson that many of us have had to learn or have had to think about over the last couple of years, isn't it? As government COVID restrictions have curtailed our freedoms in ways that many of us have struggled with. But look, the biblical principle is clear and it's repeated throughout the Bible. And it's what's guided the way that we have responded as a church, given us principles that can help us. Those in authority over us have been established by God, whether we agree with them or not. And so when laws are set, even if they seem inconsistent and illogical, which some of them have over the last 2 years, we agree, while we might seek to change them and lobby against them, our default position should be to submit to them, even if we disagree with them. Theologian Philip Ryken summarizes what the teacher is saying here like this. He says, our submission to authority on earth is one important part of our submission to Christ in heaven. However, while the general principle in the Bible is that we should obey those in authority, there is a red line, as the second half of verse 3 makes clear. The teacher says there, do not stand up for a bad cause. Literally, in the Hebrew, an evil cause. You see, if obeying those in authority will lead us to sin, then we have a higher duty to God to obey him. For example, in Acts chapter 5, when Peter and the apostles were told by the governing authorities over them, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, when they were told, do not stop preaching the gospel, stop telling people about Jesus, how did they respond? Verse 29 of Acts chapter 5, we must obey God rather than human beings. This was an issue of the gospel. And so they said, well, actually, we're going to obey God, not you. And there may well be a time when we have to respond in a similar way with that form of civil disobedience, because God is the highest authority. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, the teacher encourages us to be wise and careful about how and when we disobey, how and when we provoke those in authority, how and when we oppose those in authority. He says a wise person will be very careful and think carefully before they do that. Look at verse 3 and 4. This is really pragmatic wisdom here. Verses 3 and 4, the teacher urges his readers to think carefully before taking a stand on a particular issue. Why? Because the reality is that a king will probably do what he wants to do anyway. Look at verse 3. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, what are you doing? The teacher gives us some very pragmatic advice here. This is how to live wisely in a fallen world, he says. Be careful about what the fights you pick. Be careful about the fights you pick with those in authority over you. Be wise about that. In fact, in verses 5 and 6, he goes on to say that sometimes it's better to just live with something you're not happy with, quietly, under the radar, than rebel and make things 10 times worse. Look at verse 5. Whoever obeys his command, the king's command, will come to no harm. And the wise heart will know the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and procedure for every matter, though a person may be weighed down by misery. The teacher says, sometimes it's wiser to do nothing and bide your time and wait for the right moment to act and to speak, in whatever context we're talking about. At work, nationally, locally, home, sometimes silence is the best policy, even if it makes things harder in the short term. Do you notice what the result of doing that is? Even if you're weighed down by misery. Sometimes it's hard to live with rules and regulations and diktats that we don't like. It makes us miserable, particularly in a workplace context. But the teacher says we need to be wise. We need to be wise about when and how we oppose those God has put in authority over us. We're to respect their God-given authority. That's the principle. But then alongside this, secondly, if we are wise, we will also recognize the limits of their power. Having reminded us of the God-given power of those in authority over us, the teacher says in verses 7 and 8, their power is limited. He reminds us that whoever we are, whether we're leaders or not, we're all powerless in three key areas. Look at verse 7. See if you can spot what they are. Since no one knows the future, who can tell someone else what is to come? As no one has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the time of their death. As no one is discharged in time of war, so wickedness will not release those who practice it. The teacher reminds us here that while we might like to think we have some degree of power over our lives, the reality is that we're powerless over the things that really matter in life. Verse 7, he says, we don't have power over the future. Verse 8, he says, we don't have power over death, just like we can't control the wind, so we can't control the time of our death. And again in verse 8, he says we don't have the power to discharge ourselves from sin and its consequences. And this lack of power in these areas is universal. It applies just as much to those in positions of authority as it does to ordinary plebs like us. Did you notice the repeated phrase in those verses? Verse 7, no one knows the future. Verse 8, no one has power over the time of their death. Verse 8 again, no one can discharge themselves from their sin. You see, while human authorities have a degree of power, their power is limited. It's bounded. It's actually very small, relatively speaking. And in verses 9 and 10, that is brought home to the teacher when he sees the funerals of powerful people. C.H. Spurgeon once said, the sight of a funeral is a very healthy thing for the soul. And that's what the teacher realizes in verses 9 and 10. All this I saw as I applied my mind to everything done under the sun. There is a time when a man lords it over others to his own hurt. Then too I saw the wicked buried, those who used to come and go from the holy place and receive praise in the city where they did this. This too is meaningless. The wicked, whose funerals the teacher describes here in verse 10, were clearly powerful and influential leaders. They could go wherever they wanted, even into the holy place, the temple, indicating maybe they were religious leaders that, whose funerals he'd seen. And you notice they were praised and honoured by everyone in the city, wherever they went. But while, verse 9, they may have lauded it over others, in life, they had no power to hold back death. Their power was limited to this life. And the same is true today of even the most powerful and influential leaders. Those in authority over us might have some power in whatever context they're in, but the most important things in life are outside of their control, which is why we can happily submit to their authority in the lesser things of life, the things that don't really matter in the big scheme of things, because we know they don't have power over the things that really matter. The big things, the important things, the eternal things. Only God has power over the future. Only God has power over the timing of our death. Only God has power to discharge us from the penalty of our sin. These are the things that really matter in life. So these are the things we're to focus on. The teacher says wise people have a sense of perspective about what really matters. And that perspective informs the way that they respond to those in authority over them, especially when they disagree with them. They can submit in the lesser things of life that in the big scheme of things don't really matter, because they know God is in control of the things that really do matter. The teacher says wise people keep things in perspective. They remember the limits of a leader's power. But what about when a leader isn't just imperfect or illogical or inconsistent, but unjust, even abusive? Well, that's the scenario the teacher moves on to in verses 11 to 14. Thirdly, he says the wise way to respond to unjust leaders is to remember that one day justice will be done. One day justice will be done. In verse 11, the teacher describes the frustration people, maybe you've experienced this, the frustration we feel when those in authority allow the guilty to go unpunished. Look at verse 11. When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. Isn't that true? When a sentence isn't carried out, when someone, the guilty, go unpunished, we are tempted to take matters into our own hands. We don't like it, do we, when those who are guilty get away with it scot-free, when those in power do nothing. In verse 14, the teacher highlights another unjust pattern that we so often see in the world. Verse 14, there is something else meaningless that occurs on earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. We live in a fallen world, and so sometimes bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. But that feels so unfair, doesn't it? It feels so unjust. And what's more, so often those in authority are either in on it or are powerless to do anything about it. But between those two verses, verses 12 and 13, the teacher gives us a different perspective. Wise people, he says, remember that one day perfect justice will be done. Verse 12. Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow. Although the world is full of injustice, and although sometimes we are treated unjustly by those in authority over us, one day, the teacher says, perfect justice will be done, because God is just. He's a God we're to fear, we're to have a reverence of, because he's a just God. And one day the guilty will go unpunished. They won't get away with it scot-free. In verse 13, the teacher says, just as shadows are dependent on the sun, so the wicked cannot extend their lives any longer than God allows. They may get away with their crimes in life, but one day they will stand before God. And if they've not repented of their sin and turned to him before that moment, it will not go well for them on that day. The point the teacher is making in these verses is clear. God is the one we should fear and revere, not human leaders. He's the one with the power. He's the one with all authority. He is the one we should fear and revere, not human leaders. Even if justice is not done in this life, even if we're treated unfairly and unjustly, we can be sure it will be done in the next. And if we know God as our Father, this truth should free us to get on with enjoying life, which is the fourth piece of wisdom the teacher gives us. In verse 15, he says, wise people don't focus all their energies on the failings of human leaders. They don't get obsessed with that. They don't become fixated on that. No, instead, they rejoice in God's faithfulness. In verse 15, the teacher returns to a theme he's repeated a number of times already in Ecclesiastes. And next week we're going to see he returns to it in a fuller way. One of the ways we find joy in a fallen world is by seeing, spotting, and being thankful for all the ordinary blessings God gives us. We were reminded of that earlier in the family slot, weren't we, in Alistair? Look at verse 15. So, I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. Despite the challenges that come with living in a fallen world, God is unfailingly faithful and kind. And we see that every day when we get up and eat our breakfast, and aren't, you know, in a warm home, and have friends that we can turn to. And the teacher says, when human leaders let us down, stop fixating on their failings. Remember the unfailing faithfulness of God. Focus on that. Discipline your mind to focus on that. Don't become disillusioned if a leader lets you down. Give thanks that God never lets you down. Don't become bitter if you've become treated badly. Rejoice that God treats you far better than you deserve. Don't become resentful if you've been overlooked. Celebrate that God has set his love on you and made you a member of his family. You see, when leaders fail us, and they will, the teacher urges us, focus on the faithfulness of God seen in the ordinary, everyday gifts he gives us that are not difficult to see if we open our eyes and recognize. Rejoice in God's faithfulness. Focus on that. And finally, when disappointed by earthly leaders, recommit to the only perfect leader. In verses 16 and 17, the teacher's gloomy conclusion, we've got used to those, haven't we? The teacher's gloomy conclusion is that even the wisest human leader doesn't have the answers we need to make sense of life under the sun. They're just not the saviour we expect them to be often. They can't give us the answers we want. Look at verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the labour that is done on earth, people getting no sleep day or night, then I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it. The teacher concludes his search for leadership in a profoundly pessimistic way. Even the wisest, he says, even the most conscientious leader, even the leader who gets no sleep day or night, he can't give us the answers we're looking for. They may claim to, but they can't. But as those who live after the coming of Jesus, we have a perspective that the teacher didn't have. Because we know there is a leader who is able to answer all of our questions about life and death and the future. In Jesus, God sent us a leader who laid down his life to save us, who rose from the dead to secure us, and who will one day return to claim us. In Jesus, God sent us a leader who has all authority in heaven and on earth and conquered everything that threatens us and will never disappoint us and will never let us down. There is only one perfect leader. There is only one King of Kings. There is only one Lord of Lords. And it's Jesus. And so when we are disappointed and disillusioned and let down by human leaders, whether that be a politician, a parent, a boss, a teacher, or a pastor, our response should be to run to Jesus, to turn again to Jesus, to recommit ourselves again to Jesus. When we come to Jesus, our search for a leader we can believe in and count on is over. Turn again, turn for the first time to him. You may have seen in the news this week that Peel Island, just off the coast of Cumbria, is searching for a new king. It would be more accurate to say they are searching for a pub landlord. But because the successful applicant's job is to run the 200-year-old pub on the island, so that's probably a more accurate description of what they'd actually be doing. But because the landlord's responsibilities also include management of a 14th-century castle on the island, whoever takes it on is traditionally crowned King of Peel in a ceremony that involves sitting on a throne while wearing a crown and holding a rusty sword while buckets of beer are poured all over your head. If you're interested, I think applications are still open. The end of Ecclesiastes chapter 8, the teacher concludes, we should all just give up our search for a king because no one is up to the task and no one is good enough. But when we turn to the New Testament, we discover he's wrong. We have a different perspective. In his grace, God sent us the perfect king in Jesus, one who will never let us down, one under whose authority we can gladly submit. When we come to him, the search is over. And so we're to gladly commit our lives to him. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you that when we turn to you, our search for leadership is over. Thank you that you are the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and that our lives and our future is safe in your hands. Thank you that if we put our trust in you, you will never let us down or disappoint us. Thank you for those in authority over us that you have established. Help us to be wise in the way we respond to them, And help us also to keep a sense of perspective and remember that the things that really matter, issues of life and death and the forgiveness of sin, are in your control. And because of this, help us to enjoy life, to enjoy the good gifts that you give us with thankfulness. And help us to joyfully serve you and commit ourselves to you as our King in this week to come. For we ask these things for your glory. Amen.